Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Hope everyone had a nice holiday. We are back to kick off 2022 with a big show. We've got Al Michaels and Tom Rinaldi together to talk about the life of John Madden and the broadcasting career of John Madden. Tom Rinaldi was a director on the Madden doc that aired on Fox on Christmas Day, and Al obviously was John Madden's partner for 7 years. So we have a roundtable as a tribute to John Madden with Al Michaels and Tom Rinaldi. And then following those two gentlemen, Sal Acotta joins us for our weekly Train of Thought segment. Sal, not on the pod last week because of the holiday and some scheduling stuff. And he joins us this week, even though he's battling COVID. So you can hear about that in the Train of Thought segment. If you missed any recent episodes, last week we closed out the year with a roundtable with Peter Schrager from Good Morning Football and Andrew Perla from CBS Sports Radio. 2 weeks ago, a sports media year in review with Andrew Marchand and John Oran. 3 weeks ago, Troy Aikman. 4 weeks ago, Stanford Steve from ESPN. So if you missed any of those, check them out in the archives, subscribe, rate, and review. All right, Tom Rinaldi and Al Michaels to discuss John Madden right now, followed by Train of Thoughts on the SI Media Podcast. All right, joining me now, and I really appreciate both of these guys doing this together. We've got Al Michaels, who worked with John Madden for many years. Tom Rinaldi, the director on the great Madden documentary that debuted on Christmas Day and then aired a couple of times after his death. With the timing was just extraordinary. But Al and Tom, thank you so much for doing this and coming on to talk about John Madden. I appreciate it greatly.
Thanks for having us, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Al, before we talk about Madden, Al, I just got to tell you, because I feel like you can appreciate this. About 10 minutes before we started taping, news broke that legalized gambling is coming to New York starting Saturday at 9 a.m. So I'm in a very good mood right now, Al. Figured you'd appreciate that tidbit.
You'll be camping out there on Friday night, I assume. No TV started, right? I bet you'd be the first guy in line.
All you need now is this. There's nothing else you need. All you need is the phone.
Here's mine.
Yeah. So at 9 a.m., I'll be ready. Of course, they do it right when the college football season ends. But
well, you can bet the Premier League, right? That'll be the first thing you can get into.
I'll take anything at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. Al was on the doc that Fox aired. Tom, I want to just a couple of things here. Tell me how it came about. What made this doc happen? And, you know, like I said, the timing was just extraordinary that it aired on Christmas Day. John passed on the 28th, but we know he got to see the doc. So tell us how it happened, how John felt about it, and then sort of what happened in the day or two, you know, leading up when he ended up finally passing away there, surprisingly.
Jimmy, the origin, and Al knows this, I think we discussed it around his interview. The origin really came from two people who decades ago worked on John's crew. And that's Eric Shanks, the CEO of Fox Sports, and Richie Zions, whose crew I am privileged to work on now, along with Joe Troy and Aaron Andrews. And they revere John, love him. And Eric called me almost a year ago now, late January, early February, in my first year in 21 with Fox, and said, we want to do a tribute to John, not necessarily a deep dive on his coaching career, but something that's a bit different than that, a tribute that also looks at how he remade sports broadcasting, the video game, the cruiser, the different pop culture elements to his life. And ultimately, that was the impetus. Fast forward 38 interview requests later, and Jimmy, I've said this to a couple of other people, and I'm always struck by their reaction, you know, from trying to book guests. 38 requests, 38 yeses. Every person who we asked to speak to said yes. And the most important thing for Joel Santos, the fantastic co-director, and myself, Joe Nargi, our editor, the entire wonderful team, Skip Clark, the DP, all knowing that John, and I know Al feels this way too, that John was able to hear Al, to hear that chorus of voices gathered with his son, Mike, with his family, and really get the chance to absorb how people felt, what they thought 3 days before his passing. As you say, Jimmy, it's just an incredible piece of timing. We're obviously so sad about John's passing, but we're so grateful knowing that he was able to see it and that he liked it.
What month did you do the interviews with John in person where he watched the screen and stuff like that? When did that take place?
That was over the summer. That was the principal interview with John. We went up and visited him a couple of subsequent times, audio only, but that was over the summer. And again, Al knows this well, in Pleasanton, as part of Goal Line Productions, the production company that he owns. He has a soundstage there that incredibly, that's the space where he watches NFL games on Sunday. And that we constructed our own video screen, and that was where we played the clips for him.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that where we saw him in the dock, that's where he watches the games on Sunday. Al, have you ever been there? Have you ever seen that set up?
I have. Yeah. When I was with John, those seven seasons, we taped some ancillary stuff up there, but it's a great setup. He's got all kinds of, you know, it's like a sports bar basically. Right. With the chairs and the big screens. And John would be the kind of guy who on a Sunday after his retirement would sit there and watch seven games at once. He was like, Pereira is in the Fox studios, trying to watch every game and weigh in on every rule that comes into play. So he loved it. I mean, John would get up, you know, early on Sunday on the West Coast, watch the 10 o'clock games. Watch the games at 1 o'clock, 1:30, and then the Sunday night game. Then, of course, be there on Monday night as well. He didn't miss anything. He loved it.
Interesting. Now, I don't want to get morbid, but I have to just for a second. Tom, when news came that he passed on the 20th, was that a complete shock? Did you hear anything about bad health leading up to it, or a complete stunner?
No, I was stunned. Not to say that it, and again, I know Al, because of his friendship with John, was aware of some of the health challenges that John had had in his life. He was 85 years old, Jimmy. But regardless of those, being aware of those concerns, I was still stunned. The very first call I made was to Mike Madden, his son. I was fortunate that Mike picked up, and Mike shared again this feeling, this gratitude that the family had that John was able to see this. And this notion that I think people have talked about with myself and with Joel Santos, that I think Al can relate to, that so often we do these tributes, Jimmy, once someone is gone, right, and someone doesn't have the opportunity to hear and know how others appreciated, felt, loved them. We're just so grateful that in this case, John was able to.
Al, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I talked to Mike when John died on Tuesday. Tuesday. And I called Mike on Thursday, late afternoon, early evening, up in Pleasanton. And he picked up and he says, "I can't believe this." He said, "My mom and I are sitting here watching the documentary." They had seen it on Christmas Day. They were watching it again. He said, "As I'm calling, there I am on the screen," and he actually sent me a screen grab.
Wow.
So he and Virginia, mom, were watching the documentary again on Thursday night. And, you know, I'm so glad, you know, and Tom's right. I mean, wow, the fact that John was able to see it, and at the end of it, it was perfect. I mean, just the way he was blown away by what people were saying about it, even though he sort of, you would think he would have to know that. But then you sit there for an hour and a half and you watch what people say. And as Tom said, you know, you're 38 for 38 to be interviewed. And this is because everybody loved John. Yeah. And Jimmy, you know, you go back to everything you've read and heard about John over the last few days, 100% positive. How many people are 100% positive? And somebody said to me on a radio show the other day, "Tell me something negative or bad about John." I said, "What? You want me to make something up?" Sorry, right. Nothing there.
You know, it's funny because I have it written here in my notes I was going to mention is, you know, I feel like, you know, John's been out of the public spotlight and retired from doing games. It's been a while now.
13 years.
And on the internet, on social media, the internet, doing what I do, covering this stuff, you know, we always talk about like the only person we've ever, you know, that we always talk about being universally liked, who we've never heard a bad word about, is Vin Scully. Mm-hmm. And when John passed, it hit me that like John's in the same exact category as Vin. There's not one person who has a bad thing. I think we, you know, Vin only, amazingly, Vin Scully only retired a couple of years ago, whereas John, like you said, has been out of the picture for many years. And I think he was just sort of an out of sight, out of mind guy, never had a social media presence. Whereas Vin was still working and clips of Vin would still get posted all the time on Twitter. Those are the two guys that, you know, you say who else, I think it's just Vin Scully and John Madden. I can't think of anyone else. No offense to Al. I know you call games, but you're working in the social media era. So you're going to get people who don't like you in this day and age.
Oh, but of course. And yeah, I mean, John and Vinny is close to being universally loved. I'll tell you somebody who died the other day too. Betty White.
Betty White.
Again, yeah. It's not in sports casting, but Betty White, I mean, you see all of the accolades that, are tossed her away, almost living to be 100 years old. And yeah, I mean, there was something about John. There's something about Vin, not only what they did professionally, but just their manner, the way people perceived them. And for John, even though he was out of the limelight, I mean, the Madden game was right. Still there every year. That was important. And every once in a while, you'd see John show up at something, but he's one of those guys. I mean, you know, you just don't forget him. Anybody who remembers him. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting, Jimmy, is that the last game John did was the Super Bowl in Tampa following the 08 season, Pittsburgh against Arizona. I did the game with him. It was the end of our seventh year together. And I never walked out of a booth and felt any better than I did that day, because I thought every element of the show hit. You have James Harrison running back an interception 100 yards, Santonio Holmes' catch, Larry Fitzgerald having a fantastic postseason, scoring with 2.5 minutes to go to give Arizona the lead. What are they doing in the Super Bowl to begin with? It was everything was great. The pictures were terrific. John, I thought, was as good as he's ever been. And that was it. So there's a glow. And I walk into the truck afterwards and everybody's, you know, toasting each other. And then I go home and I'm thinking, wow, this is so great. I mean, John is still top of his game. 7 years into this thing. Next year, we're going to open up Sunday Night Football because Dallas is going to open up their new stadium. So we know we're going to get the Cowboys at Jerry World. And then all of a sudden in April, you know, Dick Ebersole calls me and he goes, I've been out here for a week trying to talk him into going on. And no. And when John stepped aside, all he said was, it's time. He didn't need any fanfare. He didn't need any going away celebration or tour or anything like that. That was John. It's time.
So it's funny because in the doc, one of the, you know, I thought it came across pretty strong that when Madden says he's done, he's done. He did it with coaching, never went back. And he didn't seem like the type of guy that would waver on a decision. The one thing I think maybe he wavered on, which I found fascinating and didn't know about the doc, Tom, was he didn't want to be a broadcaster. He resisted for a while. And he had a great line in there from his agent, because I guess John wanted to put it off for a couple of years and his agent's like, they may not want you in a couple of years. And then obviously look what ends up happening. So the fact that the man who's perceived as the greatest NFL analyst of all time didn't want to do it was very interesting in the doc, Tom.
Right. Well, maybe, I think John wanted to be great at whatever he did, right? He was great at coaching and whatever else he was going to do in life at that point. And I think there may have been a little bit of trepidation about how does this work? You know, I don't want to sound like everybody else I've heard, but it didn't take John long. I mean, and the thing that with John too, when John got into something, he immersed himself in it. Same thing we talked about the video game. They came to John. Can we put your name on it? Well, yeah, only if I am involved, deeply involved, and I can make this game exactly what I want it to be. So there was, you know, if like with restaurants, hey, can we put your name on it? You never show up, you eat across the street. Oh, no. John needed to be totally engaged in whatever he did.
Tom, go ahead on that.
I think Al said it perfectly. And I think through Sandy Montag and through some of the other voices, I think this notion of Barry Frank saying to him, hey, you know, if you say no now, they may not want you a year or two from now. And the fact that John, Al knows this well, did not have much respect for nor hold in very high regard broadcasters. You know, Mike recounts the anecdote after a difficult Monday night loss when Cosell passed him in the bowels of the stadium and said, "Great show, John." And John, I'm sure Al can tell you how John would have reacted to that kind of comment. You know, John got very fired up. "We're living and dying out here. What kind of show are you talking about?" And to go back to, I think Al said it perfectly when the person asked, "Hey, what about a negative?" That's not to say, and I'm sure Al will attest to this, and so will Fred Gaudette and Drew Isikoff and Richie Zions. John was demanding as a coach, and he was demanding in the booth because he wanted greatness. He wanted greatness from those around him. And once he was freed from the incredible yoke and corrosive nature of losing and defeat, all of the savant-like knowledge could be attached to just a more pure version of joy, Jimmy. And I think that's what radiated and worked so magnificently initially with Pat, and then, of course, for the great seasons in primetime with Al.
Al, you want to say anything about that Cosell anecdote since you had some history there with Howard?
But before that, I want to just piggyback a little bit on what Tom just said. Yeah. He was demanding, but you know what? People loved to be with him. He would show up every week full of energy. He was an energizing sort of guy who got along with everybody on the crew. And I've said this over the past week a lot, that he made everybody around him better. Because he had such a standard. And you know he would come totally prepared. And he wanted to be as perfect as he could possibly be. And so he lifted everybody in that direction. Everybody. We were all, he made his players better. You heard all of them in the documentary talking about what kind of a coach he was. He made all of us on the broadcast group, he made all of us better as well. With the Cosell thing, I can picture it because, you know, I was thinking about recently. I mean, I worked 7 years with Madden and I had 9 years with Cosell. So, I mean, I ran the gamut here, folks. The difference was, I mean, Howard was all over the place. I loved him at first, and then he became a real pain in the ass toward the end. He just didn't want to be there, and he was a downer for the crew. I mean, the last couple of years when I did baseball with him, he'd come and he was almost morose. John was the complete reverse in that regard. But anyway, that's not to diminish Howard his entire career, because he was a lot of fun to work with for a long time. But I can see that. I mean, when you do a game, what you want in a game is drama. And apparently that night, whatever the game was in Oakland, there was a lot of drama. And Oakland probably suffered a very dispiriting loss. And for Howard, all it was, "Hey, how was I on the air tonight? Period. You know, oh, we had a great show. See you around. Goodbye." Oh, yeah. I can picture that 10,000%, of course.
That's a great combo there, Howard and Madden. Al, you mentioned a little while ago, you mentioned his wife. Tom, I thought his wife was tremendous in the documentary. I mean, so straightforward, so real. I thought she was great. And one of the things I thought about after, you know, the news came that he had passed, you know, you mentioned at the top 38 interview requests, 38 yeses came out to a 2-hour documentary. There must be so much more footage you have. Any thoughts, plans to maybe throw on an extra hour, release him? I mean, I would love to see more of his wife. I thought she was tremendous in that documentary. Tom, you want to go on that?
Again, Al will certainly jump in here plenty about Virginia, who is just as much of an American original as John is, a coach's wife who owned and ran a bar, as Al knows, while John coached the Raiders.
When she said that in the doc, it made me. I was talking to the TV. I was like, whoa! I want to know more about that. Wait, he's an NFL head coach, and the wife is running a bar. That could be a whole thing right there.
And Virginia also was somebody who was pursuing and very interested in a pilot's license, while John refused to fly. Obviously, as a manifestation of the claustrophobia and the anxiety attached to it. Virginia was wonderful. And I'm sure I was fortunate to speak to her just a couple of nights ago. She sounds great. obviously, she's sorrowful, but also very grateful. And knowing that, you know, listen, the day after the documentary aired, Jimmy, was their 62nd wedding anniversary. Wow. And I know Al knows that. And I just think, Virginia, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because we so enjoyed it from the very first moment of her saying, you know, people would always tell me, well, you can't win them all. Well, why can't you?
She said that was great. And then she said he had one flaw. What, he couldn't drive? Was that the
flaw? He failed his driver. Failed his driver's test. Yeah, that was it. Virginia was gold.
Virginia, I mean, you just have to love the fact that she was trying to get a pilot's license and John refused to get on an airplane after 1979. But irony, we're talking about the anniversary. So I think it was their 48th or 49th anniversary. It's 2008. And we are going to do, as is the case this week too, the game, we get the last game of the season on Sunday night. And this week, of course, we get Chargers Raiders, which is perfect. It's win in, lose out. So in 2008, we're looking for that game, or as close to it as you can get. And the game looks like it's going to wind up in New York. I can't remember whether it was the Jets or the Giants. So it's the week before, and we're going to get the New York game. But what happens? Buffalo somehow comes from behind in Denver and beats them with a big fourth quarter rally. And then San Diego wins. And then the only game that's going to be win in, lose out, is Denver at San Diego. Now, what was going to happen is that John had bought a great piece of jewelry, because Virginia was going to make a very rare trip to join John in New York. And they've got these plans, and maybe we'll do a little Broadway, blah, 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 blah. And then the Buffalo Bills come in and beat Denver, and we're going to San Diego. End of that trip. So John had to get in the bus and go across the country, and I guess he carried the ring with him and gave it to Virginia at some point in the offseason.
I'm glad you brought up the bus, because I am fascinated by the whole thing of him being afraid to fly, having the panic attack, and when he said he was never going to fly again, as the documentary so well showed you, he never flew again. That was it. End of story. Now, Al, when you worked with him, I assume you would fly to the stadium. You didn't take the bus with him, right?
No. Oh, no,
right.
No.
Right. Now, and another great thing in the doc, the drivers of the bus, Yarborough with the last name, I think that was great to see.
And Joe. Mm-hmm.
And Joe. Yeah, that was great. With the bus. Now, when he was coaching, no problem flying, or is it just he didn't have a choice and he did it? How did
he had no choice. Oh, no. And then when he started in broadcasting, he did fly. And by the way, so a little bit of trivia here. The last flight he took, he was doing a game in Tampa and he's flying home. And it's a Tampa to San Francisco flight that's going to stop in Houston. And he's going to change planes. And he's on the Tampa to Houston leg. And that's when he had the all-time attack and said, if this thing lands, I'm off forever. So that's when it landed in Houston. He went to the train station, took the train the rest of the way home. Now, you guys would probably, you know, you're too young to remember in the old days, airline tickets, you'd peel one off. So you'd have an O in the middle. So you'd have Tampa to Houston, and then you'd have Houston to San Francisco. So somewhere out there is the back end of the Houston to San Francisco ticket. That's probably worth about $100,000 right now. It's a museum piece.
That's amazing. So how did he get from Houston to San Diego is the question. Did he get on a train, I guess?
He took the train.
Yeah, he went right to the train station in Houston. That was it. I guess his luggage went on. I don't know what happened to his luggage. He probably picked it up. Somebody picked it up at the airport in San Francisco for him. But he got on into the train. And then he started traveling by train for a while. And then he decided to go the bus route.
Great nugget from Tom in the doc was that when this first happened, before he got the Madden Cruiser, he was renting Dolly Parton's tour bus. I thought that was a funny nugget. Do we know in doing the doc and the research, do the Madden Cruisers exist somewhere? I mean, Al mentioned that plane ticket. Where are the Madden Cruisers, Tom?
Well, the Madden Cruiser, the first Madden Cruiser, is at the Hall of Fame in Canton, and actually is refurbished. It runs, and it is used to take players and youth football teams within a 100-mile radius to come and visit the Hall of Fame, to come and help them when they're short of transportation in games. It's in use now, the Madden Cruiser, which I just think is wonderful in serving youth football in and around Canton.
Tom, is there one thing that didn't make the final cut that you wish did, that you wish we knew, whether it's an interview, whether it's something someone said, whether something John said, a storyline, anything that didn't make it that you wish you could have got in there?
Oh, there are countless things, but if I could say one, we did a wonderful interview with J.A. Adonde, the fantastic, you worked at ESPN and the L.A. Times, and J.A. kept for a season, just at his own volition, a small notebook, and whenever he heard John say something that struck him, he wrote it down, and he had this old notebook of Maddenisms, and the quote that you hear Bill Belichick read about coaches as geniuses came from J.A.'s wonderful notebook. Wow. And we had other people read other quotes from J.A.'s notebook, sometimes quotes about them, sometimes quotes about football, and react to those.
That would be great to
and
see.
To tie it back to Al, I think one of the reasons why it works so beautifully with Pat for so long, and then so beautifully with Al, is each was gifted with the really wonderful ability to allow John to go wherever he would, and then on a moment's notice, be able gracefully to punctuate it and turn. And that's just a gift. It's just a natural wit and ability to be brief and connected to your partner and know how to do that. And I, you know, obviously we wish so much that Pat were still with us and we could have interviewed him, but there are countless things along that we wish we could have included. But at 90 minutes, obviously there's a limit, Jimmy.
I know you guys are at the top of your craft, so it's getting scary for me that this is like the fourth time where you've led into the question I was about to ask. You guys are good, because my next question was going to be to Al, and I was going to ask Al, when John goes over to Monday Night Football to join you, did you have any, I don't even want to use the word hesitation, because I don't think it would be hesitation, but was there any thought in the back of your head like, okay, he just worked with Pat Summerall. They're thought of as the greatest crew ever. Now, you know, as a weird example here in New York, we had Mike and the Mad Dog for so many years. No one can ever accept one of those guys with another partner. Now you've got to fill in and be the other partner when he had this transcendent sort of partnership with Pat Summerall. What were your thoughts when that first happened?
Number one, I was very excited to have the chance to work with John. And my style would be different than Pat. And John and I talked about that after we got together and he'd made the deal. And I said to him, I said, you know, I've been listening to you. You know, I probably heard you do a couple of hundred games. You heard me do a couple of hundred games in the bus. You'd get on the bus after the Sunday game and see Monday Night Football on the road. How do you feel about if I may want to engage you a little more deeply into certain things? And John said, I'd love it. So at that point, he'd had 20 or 21 great years with Pat. But in a way, maybe it would be a little bit different. And I think I was able to do that with John and get him to go into areas when I would hear him all of those years at CBS and Fox. There were times when I would hear him say something and I'd want to go, whoa, we can go a little farther than this. A classic case would be when John knew in the Super Bowl with New England against Green Bay in New Orleans that Parcells was not going to come back. And Parcells was being very evasive about that as the coach of New England. And you could tell by what John was saying that he knew that Bill wasn't coming back. And it was kind of left there. I remember watching that game, and I brought that up with John specifically. I said, if I'm doing the game with you, we're doing a deeper dive into that, basically. He said, I'd love it. He was fine with that. The great thing about him, obviously, we would talk about a lot of things in production meetings or at dinner about things we may want to discuss on the air. But if we hadn't even discussed anything, and it was like it just popped up far afield, it didn't matter what it was. I had so much confidence that John would rock and roll with it. And he did. He was so smart about so many things. No matter where I went, he got it. He got it. And he was able to, we were able to do a great back and forth. It was just, look, it was 7 years of just, of a wonderful time. Fun times, interesting times. As I said, he made everybody around him better. And he always made it exciting to go to work.
Now, on the flip side of that, Tom, the documentary gets into a little bit of early on, Pat Summerall didn't know if he wanted to work with Madden because he had a good thing going with Tom Brookshire. Was that just the case of CBS at that point saying, well, we're going to try you out with Madden and see how it goes? And that's just like slightly before. How quick did it become where Madden and Summerall were thought of as this legendary broadcast team? And how quick did they click?
Well, I will say, and I'll defer a bit here to Al, but I do think, Jimmy, you know, the notion that they were legendary, that's something that's granted over time. I think there was no question that late window on Sundays and the fact that it would be that particular package and it would be Summerall and Madden, how connected they were to that conference, that window, that time, when you were locked in. As you know, people are still now to the NFL in such incredible numbers. I defer to Al to say, you know, Al has worked on the biggest games, the biggest projects, not only in the NFL, but across all sport. And I do think, Jimmy, that when you're in it, I don't know how aware you are of how revered or
right.
I think it's difficult to know. I think that Al could be able to speak to that far better than I could.
I would assume he had to know that once the commercials got rolling and he's on SNL and then he had to know it. I mean, you know, maybe not those. I wonder if they had any sort of bumps in the road, maybe the first 2 years, or if they gelled right away. Al, I don't know if you know anything about that.
It probably took a little while, but then, you know, then obviously, I mean, John was so smart. And Pat as well too. So once they got going, I think they figured out what the rhythm was going to be. I don't think it took very long. I remember, you know, watching just as a viewer during those years, and it maybe it didn't click the first night, but it wasn't very long before you really began to understand. Hey, there's a rhythm. It's like you're singing a song here. There's the lyrics and the melody, and you just want to be in sync with each other and be in sync with the game. So John was, one thing about John understood his popularity. He knew who he was, but he never put on any airs. He never big timed anybody. And with John, he was, I'm sure he liked the fact that he was liked and maybe loved and respected, but it was more important for John to be a learner. He wanted to absorb everything. He had an incredibly curious mind. So he never went into a situation, hey, I'm John Madden. No. He wanted to be like every man, and he wanted to hear you. He wanted to listen a lot more than he wanted to talk.
Now, I'll say Jimmy, I'm sorry, but just to piggyback on that, and I'm sure Al can speak to this, that manifested, Al, in the lobby hangs, and how he would position himself in a lobby. Talk about that that we weren't able to get that in the documentary. I think this is fascinating,
yeah.
Jimmy.
Oh yeah. He loved to engage with people, and people would see him and they'd come by and he would discuss anything and everything. And of course, for the most part, they wanted to know about football and about their team. He's in a town, you know, in a given town. They all want to know, hey, what do you think? How the Chiefs gonna be today, Cowboys, et cetera, et cetera. It's so funny. Because I mentioned Cosell. Cosell used to sit in the lobby all of the time too. But Howard wanted to be recognized. And Howard, among other things, I traveled with Cosell, he only brought one jacket. He brought the yellow Tweety Bird jacket. that he wore on television, and he'd wear that in the lobby, and he'd have a cigar, and he's got the toupee and everything. And then Howard, you know, he would almost invite people over, and Howard, he could be very funny. We went to a lot of hotels where we were there on a Saturday night, and there's a wedding going on in the ballroom, and all of a sudden the wedding party now understands that Howard Cosell is in the lobby, and they'll come out, and then the bride and groom come out, and Howard would look at the bride and say, "You know, you could have done so much better." Right? he enjoyed where, and John was very funny too, but people gravitated to John. They just loved to be with him, and he loved to be with them.
And you know, it's funny, you talk about the everyman quality and relate it to everyone. And this is not in any way, shape, or form meant to be sort of a negative, because people seem to always turn money things into a negative. But, you know, one of the things in the doc was that Fox was able, when they first got the NFL and got it from CBS, it took them $12 million to get John Madden to come over and give them the credibility they needed. Was that important? Listen, everyone says money's not important or it's not about the money, but did John, like, was it important for John to be the top paid analyst because he was the best analyst? How did he, because then he also got, from what they say, $5 million to go do Monday Night Football. So back then, I don't think people focused on salaries as much as we do now because of, you know, basically we focus on everything now because of the internet. But was that important to him at all to get the money he deserved?
I think, Jimmy, go ahead, Al.
Well, so let me make one correction here. It was $8 million.
Yes.
Murdoch paid him $8
million. Why did
in 1994, and I've told this story the last couple of days to people.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought John Madden was coming to Monday Night Football in 1994. CBS was out. That's where he was. Fox is in. Fox didn't have anybody in place at that moment in time. And a couple of our top executives at ABC went and met with John's representative at that point in a private club off Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And there was a toast that night that the deal was done and John Madden was going to come to Monday Night Football. And I got the call from our exec saying, "It's done. It'll be announced in a couple of days. You'll be doing Monday Night Football in 94 and beyond with John." Next day, I hear Rupert Murdoch has come to town with an $8 million check. And that created a bad scene between John's representative and the top ABC executive at that time. And and in fact, I can tell you another thing, too. When John then did come over in 2002, there were a couple of people at ABC Sports who basically said, "Oh no, he spurned us in 94. We don't want him." And then cooler heads prevailed. And they said, no, we have a chance to get him. And that wasn't really about John. And what was John supposed to do when we were offering him? I don't know what they offered him in 94, three or four. And, right. And Murdoch comes in with eight. And also, I think John at that point may have felt a little more comfortable staying with Pat because he'd been with Pat for a lot of years. Right. He was going to get probably his same producer and director as well, and some of the crew. So in other words, there was a little bit of a mystery had he come to Monday Night at that point, and there wasn't if you brought the whole crew together at Fox. So, but fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, as they say, you know, see when I got John for 7 years.
Right. Tom, did you want to say anything on that?
No, I think Al encapsulated it beautifully. I also think that Rupert's very simple line about, well, you know, he's a smart man. He took the best offer. I think that kind of sums it up.
And I think everyone would in that case. Ty, I mentioned earlier, but I think we sort of went on a different path, but any thoughts to doing like a bonus footage or an extra show or something with more footage?
I think just in the wake of John's passing and the, you know, we're grateful that it's streaming now on ESPN Plus on Peacock. It's been running now on the NFL Network. It got the airings that it did on Fox. It's on Tubi, which is Fox's streaming service. We're just so grateful, Jimmy, that in a show of true collegiality, which, as you know, is not common these days across competing platforms, that John yet again finds a way to unite people and unify people. And so there's many ways to see it. There haven't been any conversations yet, but I also think everyone is still processing John's passing right now. So we certainly would never say never at all.
When you can get Belichick and Parcells to sit there and share stories, you've the booking's been strong. That's for sure. That was I thought they were both really good on the dock as well. I want to transition just to a couple of NFL things because you guys have big games this weekend. Before we do that, one last thing on the Madden thing, but not really about Madden. It's about you, Al. Now, you've been on this podcast many times talking about the no vegetables thing. But the story you told the other day about ordering the French onion soup without the onions, I apologize. I forgot where you told the story. I posted the clip. I should know where you told it. When you do that, does the waiter or waitress, I don't even know if those are politically correct, servers, I don't know what the term is anymore.
Right.
Do they look at you like you're a lunatic?
Well, that night, that's in Green Bay, and, you know, I love cheese. And I do love the broth in French onion soup, and I do love the crouton. So it's not the first time I did it, but it's the first time I ordered that in front of John. And I said, can you bring me the French onion soup without the onions? And I think the server said, yeah, we can do that. And then John said, what? What did you order? So then, but when it came out, and it was perfect, because here's the crouton and the cheese and the broth, it was perfect. And then John had to bring the chef out because John had to know the forensics of everything. So he brings the chef out. He said, now, do you put the crouton in first so it gets soaked by the broth? Does the cheese go here? Does the cheese melt? I mean, but John had, he had to have the guy explain exactly how you put this thing together. Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of the, you know, that's a great story, but there were so many with John through the years, especially over dinner, because John did love food.
I was going to say, do you have a John food story? Anything you could think of maybe off the top of your head besides of like with John and food? Was he a steak guy? Was he a pasta guy? What was
he? John was a steak guy. I mean, I'll tell you a story because fishermen won't necessarily like this, but it happened. So we're in New York. We're in a nice sort of fancy restaurant back around 2005. And I ordered swordfish as my entree. And John said, oh, no, you can't have swordfish. I said, well, I love swordfish. Oh, no. He said, you know, I have a couple of friends who are commercial fishermen, and they tell me that swordfish are full of tumors and boils. This is what he says at the dinner table as I'm ordering. That was the end of that. I cannot look at a piece of swordfish again, period. I've just destroyed the swordfish market, but that's, you want to know what John said about food? That's one of the things he said about food.
I didn't see John as a big swordfish guy anyway. I think maybe.
No, he was not a swordfish guy.
A couple of things, because you both have big games this week. Before I get to that, since it's been a big controversy the past couple of days, I'm just curious. If you had MVP votes, who would each of you vote for NFL MVP this year? Tom, you go first, if you don't mind on that.
Yeah, I do not. I do not have one.
If you had one.
Yeah, if I had one, it would be Aaron Rodgers.
And what about you, Al?
I don't have one. If I had one, it would be Aaron Rodgers.
All right. I just want people have gone crazy. And I just want, like, Aaron Rodgers is still going to win the MVP award, despite what the guy said. So everyone can calm down.
He's lapped the field. I mean, a few weeks ago, there are a lot of guys in the conversation, including like Matthew Stafford, Brady. You know, I mean, yes, you can make a case, but still, I think Aaron has kind of run away with it at this point. I mean, the one guy who should get more recognition is Cooper Kupp. I mean, he is having the year of years, but, you know, God forbid a wide receiver should win one. Yeah. Maybe one of these years they will.
So now, speaking of Kupp, Tom, you'll be in L.A. Sunday for Niners-Rams. Big game for the Niners because they're currently in that sixth seed. But they go with Trey Lance this week. But it's got to be exciting for the week 17 first year. You get a game like that where there's a lot on the line there. Fox on 425 Sunday.
Exactly. And I think what Al said, you know, this is my, I'm finishing my first full season here with America's Game of the Week in the late window when Fox has the doubleheader. But I think Al said it perfectly at the very beginning, which is when you get to that last week and you have for either team, when you have a clear playoff ramification, win and you're in, that's just a really exciting juice to be a part of. And the Niners have a lot, Jimmy, swirling around them. You know, who is going to ultimately play the quarterback position in this game? Obviously, when it's division rivals, when they have a history, and how the seeding could ultimately line up, that some people have already looked and seen. Could we see Brady and Jimmy G? Could that be a potential? But there's just a lot out there. We're really excited for this one Sunday.
And Al, you have a play-in game. I mean, you basically have a playoff game with Chargers, Raiders. Have you seen this crazy thing about if the Colts lose at 1 o'clock, they both get in with a tie?
Yeah. Well, I keep thinking about it. Brand, you know, Staley said the Chargers coach, oh, no, no, no. He wouldn't even think about anything like that. I'm sure Richie Bisaccia feels the same way. I think back to the Herm Edwards line several years ago. You play to win the game. You don't play to tie the game. I can't see that happening.
Tell me, you've the game's in Vegas Sunday night. What has – is Vegas – are they all in on the Raiders? Are they rabid about the NFL and the Raiders there in Vegas? Because I just – you know, there's so much to do in Vegas. I could see a sports team sort of, you know, maybe not – and it's such a big tourist place. But go ahead, give me a little
– No, I mean, first of all, the hockey team is crazy. Yeah. I mean, they love, because Vegas has a lot of transplants. A lot of people grew up in other places, right? And, of course, Vegas has a ton of stuff to do. But you can't go to a show. You can't go to the casino every night. So you have sports. And with the Raiders in particular, tons of people fly in from the Bay Area, from Los Angeles, since they spent 12 or 13 seasons here. So you have a whole bunch of folks in Allegiant Stadium who not necessarily are from the Vegas area, but they've had no trouble, as far as I know, selling tickets. Stadium is great. It's a beautiful stadium. And sport. I mean, to me, I think if you had to say who's the next franchise that the NBA would put in, I would say Vegas. And baseball, if you build a stadium with a retractable roof because it's too hot to play there in the summertime, as well, because when you look at the Golden Knights, it's impossible to get a ticket to those games. It's fantastic. They've sold out, you know, season tickets from the locals. And then you have tons of people. You have like 200,000 or 300,000 people every weekend are in Las Vegas as visitors. And a lot of them want to go to sports events.
Al has the Super Bowl this year. Tom, do you guys have it next year, I think, Fox?
We do. Yeah, we do.
And that'll be your first Super Bowl, obviously, since coming over from
ESPN. Will be.
So that's got to be exciting for you. And what about, is there any chance? I know they just said no this morning, but there's no chance they're moving the Super Bowl, correct?
Oh God, please don't scare me.
I mean, it's in Al's backyard.
Yeah. Come on. Yeah, you know, I think the league every year is always looking at possibilities in case there was, you know, a volcano or something. I mean, there's always a contingency plan. So there is right now. But to me, I mean, I would think that the chances are extremely slight. And by the way, if you move it someplace else, who's to say that area doesn't have a huge outbreak and major problems? So right now, I'm just hoping for the best, hoping everybody can just stay safe and we can get this thing done on February the 13th.
Yeah, everyone stay inside till Super Bowl Sunday, basically. At this point. All right. Well, I appreciate you guys coming on and talking about John. Al, I made it through that the whole thing without bringing up Amazon. So give me some credit. Yeah, I had Troy on a couple of weeks ago. I asked Troy about partnering up with you. So if that happens, you know, let me know.
Right. You're my man. You'll be right at the forefront of it. But right now, it's kind of like, you know, I'm waiting for Murdoch to come in and write me a note.
That's it right there. That's how it works.
There you go. That's as far as I'm going to go.
Tom, thank you so much for coming.
We call that a callback. Yeah.
Thanks so much and enjoy the end of the season and the playoffs, guys. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks. Good to see you guys.
All right. Joining me now for our weekly Train of Thought segment. Took a week off last week, had a lot going on, the holidays. But Sal Licata from WFAN in New York and SNY TV is back. And I'd ask you how your holidays were, but I know how they were because you had COVID.
It was awful. First of all, I do feel like it's been way longer than just 1 week. Is that all I missed is 1 week?
Yeah, you just missed 1 week of the pod.
Oh, all right, crazy. So anyway, it was December 26th was what? Was that the Sunday or the Monday? Whatever.
Sunday.
So then that Monday was when I believe I came in contact with somebody who had COVID, started feeling sick mildly the next day or so, and then it just felt like I was waiting for the inevitable. And then the inevitable happened on New Year's, and it was just disastrous. And I'm still not 100%. Now my wife is sick. So, yeah, it's been great. And I know that, you know, other people can relate, especially in New York, where it seems like almost everybody has gotten it now.
I'm pretty sure every one of my friends has it or has had it in the last month.
Yeah, do not leave your house. If you don't have to, do not leave. And the worst thing is that I most likely, you never know where you got it, but I'm assuming I most likely got it at work, which is supposed to be a safe place. Nobody's fault. It happens, but especially after Christmas, right, where the people hang out.
I don't want to get into a whole thing about this, but I'm pretty, like, when you're at work, you're not wearing masks. And I think if you're not wearing masks, your chances of getting it, I don't know, maybe that's not true. Who knows? I mean, everyone's getting it, so
right.
Mask, no mask, who the hell knows?
Yeah, but, that's fair. You have no idea.
But would you characterize what you had as mild?
Probably not, honestly.
Really?
I would, yeah, because I'm still, so I don't even know what exact day it is here, but we're about a week from where I started to get severe symptoms. The way I would put it is that it was like 2 days of different things. Like it started initially with 2 days of some stomach issues. And then it was 2 days of, all right, I feel like the very early stages of a normal cold. And then boom, 2 days of can't move, shivering, freezing. I was legitimately sitting wrapped in a blanket, in a hooded sweatshirt and a woolly hat on my couch inside in the heat. That's how, and I was like good with that. Like I needed to be. That was 2 days. Then that went away, and then I started to feel okay. But then I had a cough for 2 days, and then it was a burning throat for two. It's like 2 day intervals. And the worst of it is, legitimately, like my back doing the radio show last night for 5 hours sitting in the chair. I needed to actually stand up. My back hurts. My hamstrings are hurting, and I'm like, is that part of it? The body aches is another issue of it. So
a lot of people have said that.
Yeah, I'm still about a week out, and I feel like I have normal energy. I think I sound okay, but I'm still not 100%. So,
I basically won't be hanging out with you until June.
No, I should technically be in the clear. Now, who the hell knows what that means, but I should be in the clear tomorrow is when I think they said 10 days from when you first start the symptoms.
So. Yeah, like I text you every day, like, how you feeling? And you're not like better. And I'm like, what? Should I be worried? What's going on?
You know. Well, because, you know, what's weird, I thought, and I was not like planning on calling sick to work or whatever, you know, I'm able to work from home, fortunately, so I was going to just do the shows and get it over with. And then all of a sudden Monday, I'm like, there's no way, I just can't, I don't have the energy, I can't do it. And I thought I was feeling good. The next day, same thing. I'm like, all right, I'm better. The worst is behind me. And then as the day went on, I went and just took a nap and passed out for 3 hours and woke up feeling like crap. So I'm hesitant to say I'm feeling better because I'm afraid that, and I've also heard that from other people too, when you think you're getting out of it, it kind of knocks you on your end a little bit. Now I'm vaccinated, my wife too, and we both have it. So who the hell knows? No rhyme or reason, but I think I'm starting to get better here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm terrified to say get vaccinated and get boosted, but get vaccinated and get boosted. If you're listening to this,
I don't think it could hurt. Put it this way. I don't think that could hurt. Not that one way or another, but I have a hard time thinking that could do any damage. And honestly, as somebody who was not all in on the vaccine from the beginning, I am now glad and kind of at ease that at least I had it and my wife has it, knowing that, all right, well, you know, we did get COVID and let's hope that even though it's kind of significant symptoms, it's nothing too severe to where either of us have to be hospitalized.
Yeah, it didn't end up in a hospital. So right. I just saw a stat. I can't believe I'm going to get into this, but I'll just leave it at this because I just saw this a minute ago. I'm pulling it up right here. So January 5th, 2021, last year,
okay,
235,000 COVID cases in the United States. January 5th, 2022, currently 700,000 COVID cases.
Wow.
Okay,
so
but now here's the kicker though. January 5th, 2021, 230,000 COVID cases, 3,700 deaths. This year, 2,000 deaths. So the cases are up 500. I'm rounding. I'm doing all
right. Right.
The cases are up 500,000 in terms of positive cases, and the deaths are down by almost 2,000.
Yeah.
So for the people who say the vaccine doesn't work, there you go. Okay. Now we'll move on. Let me get to this first topic. I didn't want to write about this today because I didn't want to add to this guy's misery, but the Wizards announcer, Glenn Consor, on Wednesday night throws out a line about Kevin Porter Jr. about shooting like his father did or something like that. Mm-hmm. It turns out his father shot someone and killed people or whatever. I don't want to say killed people. Shot someone. I don't know if he...
Right.
And everyone, of course, has to destroy this guy, including LeBron James and Kevin Love. And no one stepped back and said, okay, maybe this guy, that's not what he meant. He made a mistake. And he issues the apology Thursday afternoon that he thought the guy's father was Kevin Porter, the old Trailblazers guy. And his dad was convicted. So Kevin Porter Jr. of the Wizards, his dad was convicted of manslaughter. And this guy says, the announcer says he shot the ball like his father shot.
He pulled the trigger. Yeah, which is, one hell of a coincidence, though.
Well, here's my issue. How could anyone possibly think in good faith that this guy who has a broadcasting job for an NBA team is going to go on the air and say that comment? Everyone right away accused the guy of making the joke about the guy. My first reaction was, there's no way he did that. Because if you did that, you'd have to be the stupidest person. You'd be fired in a second. No one would think it's funny. I knew, and I believe the guy's explanation. Now, I guess people are going to say they don't believe the guy's explanation. This is the world we live in now.
Well, how does he not do that work, though? I don't think that he should be absolved here. It's reckless at the very least. At the worst, it's obviously horrible. Now, you're right. Maybe
no,
we shouldn't.
No, but he wasn't. Why is it reckless? He thinks...
Well, how does he think that kid's father is somebody else? It's your job as an analyst to know.
Well, I believe he's the backup analyst. I'm not 100% sure on that. But again, that's a separate issue. If you want to say, how does he not know that this guy's father was not the Kevin Porter who was in the NBA? Fine. I have no problem with that take. You can't possibly think the guy's going to go on the air and make a joke about the guy's father committing manslaughter.
When I heard it, I was like, first of all, what is it? You know, you see it come across the Twitter feed and you're thinking, what's this? My jaw legitimately dropped, which has happened far too often in recent times with some of these stories, just in disbelief of, oh my God, how can you possibly say that? So I'm with you when you hear the explanation.
My first reaction was this guy obviously didn't know or made a mistake or got people confused. That was my first reaction because an announcer is not going to go on the air and make that joke.
I would hope not. Now, I did see another clip to where he said something else on the air that was a little questionable. So, I never heard of this guy before. I've never listened to him do a second of a game. I have no idea. I just know that, okay, I could understand it's a mistake because there's no way anybody in their right mind would ever even come close to touching that. However, the excuse is not good enough. You've got to know you're doing a damn NBA game. You're telling me you don't, you're just assuming who the guy's father is?
I don't think that's so crazy.
Well, it's not a fireable offense, but it led to what could have been or could be a fireable offense because of just negligence. It's stupid.
The problem, he waited until Thursday, late morning, early afternoon to give his side of the story. He should have done it the second the game ended. Or during the game.
Well, did he not realize? I mean,
the guy probably, I don't know, maybe doesn't check Twitter because, of course, this is only a Twitter thing. And, you know, I think once LeBron tweeted it, he realized he's in deep shit.
Yeah, right. Well,
but I think that's irresponsible of LeBron to just blast the guy like that without.
Well, because it's an assumption. He's assuming that the guy did it on purpose, and there's no way is it now his word versus LeBron or his versus the person who initially? I think if you use common sense, you have to understand that it was potentially an honest mistake, but it's still a stupid, stupid. You can't understand who the guy's father is.
But you think Walt Clyde Frazier knows about the parents of every Knicks player on the roster?
I would hope that if you – now, I've been in this spot before as an analyst. And the first time that – and I – you know, there's so much work that goes into it. I don't even like doing the work, which is why I don't want to do it anymore. But I'll tell you from experience, anytime you see a name that's familiar – and this is at the college level, and obviously it's not, you know, where – you know, I'm not doing NBA games where many people hearing it. Anytime I would see a name that looks familiar, I would either ask or be like, hey, is that so-and-so's son or – and a lot of times, believe it or not, it was so-and-so's son. Like, oh, yeah, well, that's crazy that he plays for, you know, Columbia College, whatever. Yeah. My point is, if you see that, you can't just say, oh, well, that must be Kevin Porter's son. You have to ask somebody and say, hey, Kevin Porter's son?
I'm sure the guy's name is Kevin Porter Jr. He's playing for the Wizards. There was a Kevin Porter who played whatever many years ago on the Blazers. And the guy, he assumed. And yes, you should not assume. But now the guy is getting blasted by LeBron James because he made a dumb assumption. It's like, you know.
Yeah, and I just didn't understand that anyway. Let's just say it was his father, right? What does that even mean? Pull the trigger just like his father?
Because I think if he was referring to the old Terry Porter, he was a very, very good three-point shooter.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that
is. I think he got Terry Porter and Kevin Porter mixed up.
Which is even worse because we all know Terry Porter versus I don't know who Kevin Porter is. I mean,
Kevin Porter Jr. is in the NBA. His father was convicted of manslaughter. Terry Porter was on the Blazers and was a good 3-point shooter.
Right.
And
so this guy not only thought that
it's called making a mistake. The guy made a mistake. No one's allowed to make. That's the problem. No one can make a mistake. If you make a mistake, your career has to be over.
Don't you think, though, that's and I'm not saying the guy should be fired or look, everybody makes mistakes. You're right. And in today's day and age, you can't do it. That's a pretty big coincidence. No. I think about that.
It comes down to this. Do I think that that guy thought that the Wizards player's father shot someone and was convicted of manslaughter? No, I don't.
Yeah,
I think he made a mistake.
I don't know what to believe, but think about what you're saying then. He thought that this player's father was a guy who didn't even have the same first name and just assumed, like, it just, I don't know, it's many mistakes, but I understand your point. And the whole thing is just, you got to be smarter than that on the air, especially in today's day and age.
Now, on another topic, a guy who got destroyed also this week was Herb Street because he said he doesn't think today's college football player loves football because they opt out. And there's a lot of layers to this, and I wrote about it on Tuesday. But the only thing I want to say is this. If anybody thinks these bowl games are legitimate and wants these kids to go all out for these meaningless bowl games, they're not paying attention. If you're going to get drafted, protecting yourself is more important than playing in a Peach Bowl. That no one can tell you who won any bowl game last year, except for the playoffs. Now, having said that, the bowls can be meaningless and they can still be great and you could watch them and enjoy. Like I want as many bowl games. I want 700 bowl games, put them on ESPN. There should be not a minute between the end of the college football season and New Year's Day where there's no bowl games. Bowl games should be every day, every minute, but they are meaningless. That's my opinion.
I kind of understood what Herb Street and Desmond Howard, right, were both trying to say there. It's also a different time. If those guys had the opportunity that these players do now, if they had the understanding that these players do now, really back then, I don't even think it was an option. They were just playing the games. That was it. There was no, oh, yeah, I'm going to sit this game out and get drafted. I mean, I think you played in that game to try to raise your draft stock. I'm sure that you cared about the game. I don't think that today's athlete cares the same way that athletes did years ago. I just don't believe that. Not everybody. You can't just paint a broad brush with everybody. But I don't think there's any question because of the money that's out there.
What's the basis? Well, yeah, the money is different. And I think that makes athletes try to maximize their earnings more than anything. This is how I look at it. If you have a player who's going to be drafted into the NFL in April and they want to sit out the Sun Bowl, which nobody's watching unless they bet on it or their family of the kids in the bowl game, why is that a bad thing?
Well, it just diminishes the bowl. I mean,
the bowl's already diminished. Right. No one cares about the Sun Bowl.
Well, then why is it being played?
Because ESPN paid $700 million.
Right, but why?
Because people want to bet on it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm just telling you from a fan standpoint, you couldn't pay me to watch that game. Now, if there were big players in it, different story. So, but I also understand the player's perspective. I'm just saying in general too, you know, with the NBA, you think we talk about this, you know, Patrick Ewing didn't take rest days. Now these guys take maintenance days. You think Kyrie Irving's main priority is playing basketball? It's not.
But I think a lot of that has to do with the money.
That's fair. I mean, right. So then
they're not going to ruin, if they're making $300 million, they're not going to do anything to
jeopardize that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Nor would I, to be honest with you. I mean,
here's the kicker in all this. The bowl games for ESPN have done phenomenal ratings outside of the New Year's Eve two playoff games, which were unwatchable. Their bowl games, like there was a Kentucky-Iowa bowl game on New Year's Day that got 6.5 million viewers.
Interesting. Maybe people don't even care then. I mean, if you're watching college people football, don't you're care. Betting on it.
You have nothing to do over the holiday season. You're trapped in the house with your family. You can't go anywhere. There's bowl games on TV. You bet them. You watch them. You enjoy a little football.
I used to love the bowl season. I don't know why I've just gotten away from it. And there's many different reasons to it. But I think that's probably part of it.
This year is very bad. You can't have the playoffs on New Year's Eve. That's number one.
Well, what about the games getting canceled with COVID and teams replacing each other?
That's a problem. And I think people are tired of Alabama in the, you know, I feel like there's no juice for Georgia, Alabama right now.
Well, that's a whole other issue. All these years, it's cute that Cincinnati gets involved or Notre Dame or Michigan. They can't compete with the SEC. It just ultimately, I know there may be the one or two aberrations, but for the most part, it's the SEC is such a dominant conference. It's got to be able to level out at some point.
Let's go on to another topic that has nothing to do with sports. Since you've been trapped in your house with COVID, what are some of the best things you've watched over the last 2 weeks?
Great question.
Any recommendations?
For you.
Series. No, not for me. For the listeners,
Yellowstone is top notch. That's one of the best series.
Everyone likes Yellowstone.
Yeah, it's one of the best shows. I don't think you necessarily up your alley, right. but it's a fantastic show. I just binged Cobra Kai. Are you a Cobra Kai guy?
I am not. It's been on my list for 3 years to watch it.
Are you a Karate Kid fan?
Yes, love the movie.
This is a must watch, and not like, oh, it's cheesy and you might like it. It is 1,000%. As well done a show that has ever been done involving a prior history, however you want to, you know, a reboot. It is, and it just keeps getting better and better. I can't even express to you how perfectly done it is. So those are probably the two best things. I watch a ton of movies. Have you watched any of these movies on Netflix or anything like that?
No.
What the hell?
I'm watching the bowl games.
The one with Leo DiCaprio.
I watched 20 minutes and shut it off.
Yeah, I thought that was a good one, or probably one of the ones that would be interesting. So, other than that, though, Yellowstone.
I'm giving ESPN good ratings and watching all the bowl games.
Yeah, no.
The one I have to say, we talked about it early on, and I wasn't high on it in the beginning, and I do think there are a lot of issues with it. But what I do find myself watching every week is the Tom Brady Man in the Arena on ESPN.
You have ESPN Plus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to get that to watch.
There's a bundle with Hulu, ESPN Plus, and Disney Plus.
Okay.
I think you get all three for like $13 a month.
Yeah, I think I have Disney for like $8, so.
Well, so you can get Hulu. And speaking of Hulu, you better get it, because the trailer dropped for the Tommy Lee Pam Anderson movie.
Is it a series or a movie?
It's a movie.
Okay.
And I cannot wait. That's right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, I probably would check it out. It does look cheesy.
Oh, how can it not be? It's about Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee.
Yeah. Boy, I remember when that video.
I'm sure you did.
When that video came out.
I'm sure you did.
Talk about being in your wheelhouse. I mean, this was what, 1998, something like that?
'90s. And
yeah.
The best thing in the trailer is they show you how they're going to sell the two people who find the tape, which are played by Seth Rogen and Nick Offerman. And they show them plotting about putting it on the internet, and they show like the old school computer and what the old school internet looked like.
Crazy. Yeah.
That, you know, I get more into the nostalgia of that stuff. But so
I'll definitely check that out.
But that's on Hulu. It's on Hulu.
I'm not necessarily looking forward to it, but it is something I would be curious.
Looking forward to that. Yeah. I'm all in on that. The trailer got me. When I saw the trailer, I'm like, I'm all in on this.
I didn't even know
the
about
woman,
it.
She really looks like Pamela Anderson.
Who is that? Do you know?
I forgot the actress's name. But
yeah, she does a great job.
There was someone else in the movie that was big. It was I can't remember now.
Who's Pam Anderson married to today? Do we know?
Well, she was with the Julian Assange, but I don't know what's going on with that anymore. She's sort of out of the picture.
Okay.
I think you have to be of a certain age to have the appreciation for Pamela Anderson.
I mean, at the time,
and we're that age.
Yeah, right. Exactly. At the time, it was, you know, top of the world. She was it.
Did you watch Baywatch?
No.
Me either. I never got into Baywatch. But she was always on Howard a lot, Howard Stern. But I was never a Baywatch watcher.
What was it before that? Wasn't she on something? Was she on the Tim Allen show?
Oh, Home Improvement? Home Improvement. Yeah,
right.
That's where she started. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So that I remember a little bit. And then, you know, boom, took off. Barbed wire and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna get into Cobra Kai. I'm gonna make that a priority.
You won't regret it. Trust me. Now, I know you like nostalgia, and if you're a Karate Kid fan, I guarantee you, you'll be all blown away by how well it's done.
A couple of things I need to address. Just from past pods we've done, I was very happy with the reaction people had to our segment on Delilah over the holidays. Got a lot of feedback on Delilah. That's good.
That's great. Yeah.
And Sal is back on the overnights on WFAN. No more during the day. What are you on, 12 to 5? It's a long ass shift.
It's been a rude awakening, honestly. After a month of doing day part, now back to, and I'm back dealing with, you know, COVID. So that hasn't been pleasurable. But 12 a.m. to 5 a.m.
All right, that's where you can hear Sal on an Odyssey app. If you're not in New York, get the Odyssey app, and you can hear him on the overnights. Sal, feel better.
Thank you.
And let's get through this COVID issue quickly, please.
Yeah, stay safe. Be careful.
All right, take it easy. All right, my thanks to Al Michaels and Tom Rinaldi and Sal Licata for joining me on this week's episode of the SI Media Podcast. If you missed any recent episodes, go into the archives and check them out. We did a little fun roundtable last week to wrap up 2021 with Peter Schrager from Good Morning Football and Andrew Perloff from CBS Sports Radio. 2 weeks ago, Andrew Marchand and John Oran joined the pod for a roundtable on the year in sports media. Troy Aikman 3 weeks ago, Stanford Steve 4 weeks ago, all right here on the SI Media Podcast. So dip into the archives, subscribe to the pod, rate, and review. All right, we'll see you next week. Stay safe and take care.